Let me welcome you to the second session of the Levin Symposium. And we're honored today in that Scott McKnight is coming out of a session, is graciously consented to come into our session. This approach started last year when the guest who brought a lot of great exegesis and theological reflection, Walter Brueggemann, was present. And when we had our session in the morning, Brueggemann came on the middle day, and really it only took a few questions from me, and we had the entire hour was occupied. So today we're very grateful to have Scott McKnight with us. He's brought two sections already, am I right? Mm-hmm. And he'll have a third section tomorrow. And what I've asked him to do, I've asked him to take two or three themes from the book of James that would especially be appropriate and suited for ministers, church leaders, any of us, you might say, and for him to develop those scenes for, say, about 15 minutes. And then what we're going to do is we're simply going to open it up for questions. And you'll have an opportunity to have a dialogue with Scott in this section. So thank you for coming. And Scott, if you would like, just to come now.
I think Stuart would know that no professor can develop three themes in 15 minutes.
I took two or one.
We're gas bags, aren't we? All right. James, I'd like to begin where I have a new English Bible here, and the pages are all stuck, where Sarah Barton was aiming this morning, in looking at 4:13 to 5:6, you're dealing with, especially 5:1 to 6, the hottest passage in the entire book on wealth. But in James chapter 1, verse 9, James says, let me see if this translation is going to work. It'll work. I'll translate here. Let the poor brother. And this word used, poor, here is also connected to the great Hebrew tradition called Anawim, the poor and pious. Let the poor brother rejoice in his exaltation, but let the rich. And I don't think James could put the word brother with the word rich. He's incapable of making that connection. So this is not a brother, I don't think. Let the rich rejoice, this is sarcasm, in his humiliation, which is 5:1 to 6 all over again. Right? And then in James chapter 2, after James has described a comical or almost a caricature of a situation, is there in a synagogue, and a rich man comes in. He calls him gold-fingered. You know, this guy is lathered up with all the appropriate clothing that wealthy people have. You know, he's wearing Gucci shoes and high-class suit, etc. And he gets a favored seat, but the man with tattered rags on has to sit in the corner at their feet. And then James says in verse 5, listen, my brothers and sisters, has not God chosen the poor in this world to be rich in faith and heirs of the kingdom of God for those to whom he has promised who loved him? Now, the answer to the question is yes. Just in case you're debating. It's not a debate for James by the Greek grammar. All right, but you have dishonored the poor. Now he's capitalizing on what just took place in the church gathering. You have dishonored the poor. Is it not the rich who condemn you or overpower you, and they hail you into tribunals or courts? Is it not the rich who blaspheme the name by which you are called? All right. In the book of James, rich is bad and poor is good. I don't think anyone who preaches this, now Sarah worked this theme today, and it causes all kinds of disturbance. There is, for me, any kind of disturbance about critiquing the rich standing at Pepperdine. Right? I feel like I can talk like this if I'm in some poor village church in Africa or in downtown Los Angeles or Chicago. But we're the rich. Right? And the language is not in our side. It's against us. So how do we talk about this kind of theme in the book of James? I'd like to develop, Stuart, maybe just one theme.
Definitely.
Because in the pages of the Bible, as we learn to read the Bible from beginning to end rather than just dipping into a passage, which is the tendency for some people to just take this passage and think this is the whole biblical revelation on wealth. If we take the story of the Bible on wealth, this story is really mixed, and it's difficult to know what to do with it. All right? So, we have a wealth is a blessing tradition in the Bible. And this is the Bible of James, who's Jewish, and he's talking probably to Jewish Christians. And we have Deuteronomy 28, where basically, if you're obedient, you'll be blessed. Furthermore, the prophetic tradition and the book of Proverbs allow us to think that we can look at our blessings and infer that we've been obedient. Right? This is very biblical to think like this. And this is why we have a health and wealth gospel today. People read Deuteronomy and they think, well, if I trust God, God will bless me. And if I have five cars and a beach house in Malibu, well then, God's blessed me. And that's how we talk about it, isn't it? And we're very thankful that we have beautiful homes and beautiful furniture and all the clothes. I don't get up in the morning and debate and think, will I have food for breakfast? I don't think that. I get to choose which food I have. I choose which clothing. You may not think I've made good choices. And I'm at the age where I don't care. Comfort, pleated pants are perfectly fine for me. Right? So we don't choose that. We're not in that category. So we give thanks to God for our blessings. We're more like Deuteronomy than we are like James. All right. There's another tradition. This I learned from Walter Brueggemann, who is also an honorary member of the Churches of Christ. And that is the blessing tradition of wealth and health as an extension and an implication of being obedient is challenged when Solomon comes alive and he becomes opulent and he becomes concerned about having too much. And when there is descriptions about his temple and his housing and his clothing and all his wives, it's not simply that they're saying, oh, wow, God's blessed our king, is that there is a sense that he's starting to act like a pagan. And so all of a sudden the blessing tradition gets a wrinkle. Sometimes you can have a lot of wealth and it's not as a result of the blessing of God. It's a result of extorting from the poor. So it becomes a case of justice and injustice. So poverty in the time of Solomon can come from oppression as much as it can come from blessing. All right. Then there develops a prophetic tradition. And this sounds a little bit more like James. And that is compassion and work for justice. And that tradition arises. Is that there should be compassion for the poor and a belief that we should work for the poor. This develops into what we call POP, liberation theology. preferential option for the poor in liberation theology. So that there develops in the Bible this sense that there are poor people and that God is especially on the side of the poor, and they are poor because the rich have oppressed them, and sometimes it's the system that is against them, and it is systemic injustice that the prophets, say Isaiah, Micah, they inveigh against the people of Israel. So now we have a very complex story in the Bible. Right? You can see blessing from obedience, and you can see wealth as a curse. And you can be poor on the side of God, and you can be poor because you've made foolish decisions in life. Now it's very realistic, and we're kind of left to some of our own devices. Right? So then we get to the New Testament, and Jesus is poor. His mother and father don't have the money for a normal buy back my son ceremony. So they give two pigeons, two turtle doves, rather than the standard more opulent. All right? God will, it says in the Bible, he will reverse injustice. And when Mary sings her song, and I hope you sing this more than at Christmas, in the Magnificat of Luke 1, 46 to 55, we hear this theme that God is finally going to come and bring justice to the poor in this world. So God is going to reverse injustice. And yet, with Jesus, we seem to have volitional poverty. He calls for a radical detachment. Do not care about what you eat or drink or wear. Doesn't God care about the birds? I've spotted four new birds for my life list since I've been here this week. I'm a bird watcher, so. Black Phoebe, I'd never seen a black Phoebe before. They're pretty cool. So, he says, if you watch the birds, you'll see that God will take care of you. So there's a choice to be poor. And when Jesus sends out the 12 apostles in Matthew chapter 10, he tells them, don't take anything. Just trust God. And this Matthew 6, Matthew 10 is a radical detachment. But this is voluntary poverty versus poverty as a result of oppression or foolishness. So the story gets mixed and gets complex. And then there's this theme of jubilee in the Bible, that someday that the people of God will divest themselves in special ways for the sake of others. And there develops the theme of generosity for the poor in the Bible. And the Apostle Paul, I think, spent more than two decades in his missionary travels raising money for the poor saints in Jerusalem as an expression of solidarity of the gospel that Gentiles are going to support the Jewish mission. All right. Then we have the danger of riches in the New Testament, or in the Bible. You might be wealthy from blessing, but wealth has a way of strangling your heart and freezing it and keeping you from being compassionate. All right, it's in light of all this that we come to the book of James now, on poverty and wealth. We can't just take one passage and not pay attention to these themes. So this theme of James 5, 1 to 6 and poverty emerges from a certain context, and that is when leaders oppress the poor to make themselves more opulent and wealthy and rich. So this is a critique of oppression, first and foremost, not simply a critique of wealth, but the way they got that wealth, and on the backs of the poor. Now, this is directly applicable to all of America, to all of the Western world, that we need to be vigilant as Christians to pay attention to how we've gotten our wealth, and whether it is at the expense of others or on the back of others. Are we making fair wages? Are we doing things justly as God would have us do them? So, all right. All I did was just try to bring as many ideas as possible in the time that I was given to talk about wealth in the book of James. I think it emerges out of a certain kind of tradition in the Bible. So I'll leave it over to you now for comments or questions or criticisms.
Questions or thoughts? I'd like to pursue for a moment.
Yeah.
The Gospel of Luke, Walter Brueggemann, what you said is right at the heart of seeing the Old Testament ideas along this line that are. We come to the Gospel of Luke. Supposedly, we're talking about the Paul mission going out. Maybe you see it in a little different way. But you have this strong blessings, woes, found in the Sermon on the Plain. This is a gospel that twice tells go sell all that you have and come follow me. And supposedly it is the only gospel that makes that kind of assertion.
And it's good because it's in 12:33 and 14:33. It's easy to remember.
Right. And then in 19 you have Zacchaeus from... the difficulty of interpreting him in his context, but half my goods I give to the poor. Whether that's an ongoing practice of Zacchaeus, which would certainly fit into some of the things that you've been saying, or that this is a conversion statement on the part of Zacchaeus. So here it is that it seems to me that Luke has got great parallels that we're working with, but the prophetic type language that we find in the book of James stands out. Would you comment along those lines?
Well, I think in Luke, we begin with the Magnificat of Mary.
Right.
Where Mary says, my spirit rejoices for you. He's taken note, I'm using the NLT, of his lowly servant girl.
Right.
Nice. Poor, that's the word for poor. Right, so it's her economic and social destitution. He's taken look at me. All generations will call me blessed. He's brought down princes from their thrones. He's filled the hungry with good things. He's sent the rich away empty. Here's the poor and hungry versus the rich. This is Mary, mother of Jesus, rocking the cradle, singing a song to Jesus. Forever, all right. Then we have the story of Simeon and Anna in Luke, and they're both poor, and they're rejoicing that God is about to act. We have a largely ignored passage in John the Baptist in Luke chapter 3, where John the Baptist talks about repentance, and repentance is understood by John when the crowd. He told them to repent, and they said, "What does that look like?" That's my translation. He said, "If you have two shirts, give one to the poor." If you have food, share it with those who are hungry. Even corrupt tax collectors came to be baptized. What should we do? Collect no more taxes than the government requires. This makes them a zero. There's no profit if you only collect what they require. I don't know what that meant for John, but it was beyond radical. All right. Then we have the Beatitudes in Luke 6, which you brought up, where John... Jesus now contrasts blessing for the poor and woe to the rich. And then this is followed up in Luke chapter 7 with John the Baptist in prison. So this is a theme that Luke is going to carry through into Acts chapter 2 when they begin to share their goods with one another. In Acts chapter 4, they do it again. And then we see Paul vaguely in his mission of taking care of the poor in Jerusalem. So there is a radical socioeconomic vision at the core of Jesus, John, and the apostles that are a part of it. Now, Brueggemann, he has this genius theory that Moses had a democratic revolution and that Solomon undid it by turning it into a hierarchy of wealth and capitalism. Now, his socioeconomic own theories are coming into play in how he reads the Bible here. But there is some real truth in his observations here that I think are valid. So that's why I brought it up with Solomon.
Yeah, there's no doubt that the dynastic state brought a radical change in Israel's existence. And with it came that power at the top.
Pyramid.
The reinforcement of the things that you're talking about.
Yeah. Yeah. So wealth, in other words, emerges, these contexts emerge out of social conditions. They're responses. They're not just once and for all teachings.
I was thinking, you know, right on the heels in Luke 6, you've got the faith of the centurion, who was one who built a synagogue for the Jews, so he was a man of wealth.
Yes.
But maybe commenting on how you position yourself inside that kingdom versus, you know, here you still have people of possession, right? But there's a acknowledgement of reward based on the confession that I'm not worthy.
And that's why I would say, in the book of James, to be a plousios, a rich man, is to be an oppressor. And to be poor is to be pious. It's not simply socioeconomic status. It's a socioeconomic spirituality. And to be a plousios, a rich man who is generous, is no longer to be a plousios for James. So Jesus creates the vision, the apostles live this out, that they will be generous with what they have for the good of others. So if you have lots, you are marked by generosity rather than opulence like Solomon, building your own kingdoms. So I think it's very much a detachment from wealth, even in the midst of possession, but it's not goofiness. It is a strategic use of our wealth and resources for the sake of the kingdom of God. Yes?
So, what would be the oppressive position in our American context today? And has the church fallen into that in what ways?
Well, did you ask what is the oppressive context?
Yeah, who are these people that James is addressing here? Who are these people in our American culture today?
You mean name names?
Yeah.
And if they were in the church culture, how does that look
in our culture? All right, let's just put it with this to begin with. We first have to ask ourselves, am I making any money on the back of people who are not being paid a just wage? And am I being generous with what I have for the good of others? I think those we start with ourselves. Then I think we start to think systemically. Are there poor people in this world today because of what of our system? Yes, there are. And you know, there's a Marxist and a Gramscian socioeconomic philosophical theories that are out there that have operated on the basis of what's called a zero-sum game. And that is, if there's $100 and I have 95 of it, then I've taken the 95 from other people. That there should be equal distribution. That's a zero-sum game. I don't see that taught in the Bible. I don't believe that's a legitimate economic theory in our world. Nor is it the best way to create wealth for the most people. All right. So I do think, however, that we should be paying vigilant attention to our socioeconomic structures that we participate in. All right. Now, let's go to churches. I think churches should be wise, particularly in our day, with the expenses that we have to build, with how we use our funds for the good of the kingdom rather than to build up our own little kingdom. I'm willing to say this. When pastors are driving Jaguars, I think it sends a message out to the world that this is not what we want to communicate. Now, I'm using that only as a pointer to a discussion. We need to look at the not so much what the pastor makes as what social structures are in place in our church and expectations. Are the poor comfortable with us? Or do we have, for instance, invitations to parties that require a certain amount of money even to be able to enjoy or go to? We want to pay attention to all these structures.
So I'm curious if I am unknowingly participating in some way in some business that is working off the backs of poor people unfairly, and maybe I'm unaware of it. Yeah. So I understand you say that generally, but I wonder in specific ways, how could I be doing that?
Yeah. You know, there are people out there who will tell you. Let's say you buy bananas. You can find out how those bananas are being produced and purchased. I'm a big coffee drinker.
Yeah.
Well, the coffee people all know about fair trade and et cetera. All right? They're a vigilant socioeconomic society, and they're zealots. All right? So we can pay attention to these things, and I think some people are, to me, they're obsessive compulsive about this. They just, it's just constant. Well, I don't want to spend my time doing that. But I do want to know what systemic structures are in place that I'm participating in, and see if I can resist the injustices that I'm involved in.
In the last session you were doing, you were talking about the sage and how that influenced James and his writing. Is I'm thinking about the wisdom of God, Jesus as the wisdom of God, and that question he raises, who is wise among you, and this conversation about that, and it's, I'm not quite sure what I wanted to ask, but it's something that's stimulated in my mind about, as he lays out this, in some ways he's, it's probably painting a portrait of Jesus also in that, as the wisdom, and but maybe just for you to comment about the influence of the wisdom and wealth issues of how that's working itself out.
The wisdom tradition, yeah, this is good. I think the wisdom tradition on wealth, in the book of James, I think James has a prophetic tradition on wealth rather than the wisdom tradition. The wisdom tradition tends to be closer to Deuteronomy, that if you're poor, it's because you're lazy. And if you're wealth, it's because you're obedient and you're wise. If you were oppressive, then wisdom literature is not talking to you. It would be against you, and it would use prophetic language. So I think James on wealth is in the prophetic tradition of that God will bring justice for the poor because they're being oppressed by rich. That's a very limited but very important theme in the Bible. It's in Isaiah, it's in Deuteronomy, it's in Jeremiah, and it's in Jesus and James. So, am I answering your question?
Yes. It was to narrow in on the prophetic tradition.
Yeah.
And but you were also was looking at the influence of, I suppose, Jesus. Were you bring forward chapter 2:1 and 1:1?
Yeah.
And how that behind it lies the some of the teachings of Jesus.
Yeah. Let me comment on this. What I said in the last session is that the book of James is one of those books when you read it through and you say, man, this sounds like Jesus. Over and over it sounds like Jesus. But he only quotes Jesus one time in chapter 5. Why? And my contention is that James related to Jesus as a sage. And that is, he was his wise man. And a wise man has students who listen to the wisdom of the wise and embrace it. This is Proverbs 1, verses 3 through 4. And they become receptive to the wisdom of the wise. And if they're not receptive, then they're not on the path of wisdom. And I will make this free comment, and that is, we don't have a wisdom culture in our churches today. Our culture in our churches is for youth more. It favors, we want to be as young as long as we can. We don't favor gray hairs and bald-headed people. So as the older you get, the more off the platform you get. Whereas a first century or a Jewish culture favored the aged as people with wisdom. It's a conservative tradition, folks. And that's the way it worked. So, I think we need to restore and think about wisdom culture in the church. But, in the book of James, we have all these echoes of Jesus without citation because James had so long listened to the teachings of Jesus and had so deeply absorbed them that he could not speak or think without it sounding like Jesus. So even his language on wealth sounds like Jesus. I mean, it sounds like his mother Mary, right, who sang that song in Magnificat. You probably find it all in Mary. But you clearly find it in Jesus as well, and he's absorbed that, and now he's taken it to a new level in a new context. He's applied this, his older brother's teaching. Which is nice of him, don't you think? You know, I often think, what is it like for your older brother to be the Messiah? I mean, it puts some pressure on you in school. The teacher says, your brother did a lot better on this problem than you did. So, anyway, yes.
Do you think there'd be any use of even trying to find a kind of definitive answer on, okay, so what is the New Testament view on wealth and being wealthy and assessing wealth? Is it a stewardship model, or is it voluntary poverty, or is it surplus generosity, or just, you know, you need to give away as much as you can? This is like a Wesleyan understanding of,
yeah.
I don't know what is there any use of trying to find one of those, because I'm starting to write that right there. You know, that's coming.
That's
from
nothing, brother.
I'm waiting for wisdom to kind of
come. All right. I mean, this is a really good question, and I think you've gotten into the very heart of the tension of these themes that I brought up. And there is no New Testament view of wealth. There are themes that Christians are expected to play out. But I do think they can reduce to some fundamentals. Number one, all that we have is a gift from God. All right. Number two, we should be generous with what we have. And number three, we should care systemically about the structures in our world so that they reflect justice. Those are the kinds of themes that are always in play, sometimes one and sometimes another. For instance, James's attitude toward the poor probably would have been quite different in Kuyper's Holland at the turn of the 20th century. All right. He's for the poor. James is for the poor, but he knows these are poor Christians being oppressed by wealthy people who are dragging them into court, and he has a rhetoric ramped up for that situation. What happens if the poor are learning and growing and being employed by wealthy people? James is going to bless the poor for their generosity, the wealthy, for their generosity and sharing, and hoping that we'll create greater systems of equity and justice. So I think, to me, we have to take into consideration in the book of James the social conditions at work that give rise to the sayings that James makes. Jesus too. Deuteronomy too. Deuteronomy can only operate in a safe world where if you obey God, you're going to have, you know, it's going to be Lake Wobegon, and you're going to have big kids and big crops. Right? So that's a very safe world. But most of the Old Testament is not that safe.
A follow-up question on that. Now, how much of this has to do with the underlying assumption in James's view of, well, we're not supposed to talk about this today yet. Tomorrow is Kingdom Day, right?
Yeah.
Okay. But we'll go there.
I thought James was going to talk about
it. Yeah. So is James basing this understanding of the blessed state of the poor, not because they are poor, but the blessed state of the poor because of his understanding of the Father who will give to all generously who need it? Like, is that or is that poverty taken as actual poverty? As in, like, they're not going to eat tomorrow.
No, they...
All right? As in, the Father will give to those who are in need a loaf of bread, not a stone or a scorpion or what.
Well, now you're kind of mixing some passages here.
Yes.
And that God will give gifts, that's about wisdom. That's not about money and food, etc. James
the
has his
part and the generosity of God.
Yeah, God's generous. Yeah. But... James, in James, I was going to go here, this is James 2. This is a very interesting passage. in James chapter 2, verse 14. What good is it, dear brothers and sisters, if you say you have faith but don't show it by your actions? Can that kind of faith save anyone? The answer is no. All right? Suppose you see a brother or sister who has no food or clothing, and you say, goodbye and have a good day. That's a pretty loose translation. Stay warm and eat well. These are almost prayer requests. So James will not let people say, well, God will provide for you. It's your job. I love Sarah's ending. Don't debate who your neighbor is. By God, find one or something like that. That's a really good line. You know, she said, just find one. Choose one. All right, so in this passage, James does not allow people to think that they can just make prayer requests for the poor. They're expected to do something. And he says, and then you don't give that person any food or clothing. What good does that do? The answer is nothing. No salvation comes for those who respond to the poor that way.
So what else does James deconstruct? I mean, that's one thing that you can have in your mind. Well, God will take care of them, so I don't have to. Are there other things that, because I'm thinking, okay, what's hindering me from taking that step? I know a lot of things happening in my head and my journey, and I know that that's kind of, it will look differently for all of us. But what are the things that James is dealing with, especially when it comes to the rich? Like, that could be one thing about within the Christian community. Okay, this thinking that a poor brother comes to you and he asks for food, you cannot tell him or her that God will provide for you. You have to do it yourself. Are there other kind of lines of thinking that you can pick up in James that he is attacking, basically?
Well, I think on the rich, James deconstructs the notion that wealth correlates 100% with obedience. And he therefore also deconstructs that poverty correlates 100% with disobedience. So the simple Deuteronomic formula of Deuteronomy 28 and Leviticus 26 and 27 is deconstructed not only by the book of Job, but it's deconstructed by Jesus, because there are some people who are wealthy have gotten that through oppression, exploiting workers and not paying their wages. So he deconstructs those sorts of things and puts them on a different basis. But remember, this is a social context in which the wealthy are oppressing the poor. James is on the side of the poor, and he's saying that they're poor because of oppression. Right, if they were lazy and not working, James wouldn't talk about this that way. So social context. We bring this back again to the fact that we live in a different socioeconomic context, mm-hmm. where it's in a much safer world for the privileged of the United States. We work, we make good money, we eat well, we choose what restaurants we want, all that. So we have to call ourselves to account about whether we are accepting these as blessings from God and distributing and with generosity the blessings that we have received from God. So it deconstructs us from the other end. We're the wealthy now. But we're not wealthy as much by oppression the way James is talking about, but we can find it. And I think we need to be vigilant about that. Yes?
Can I understand you to say when James is addressing the rich in his letter, that those aren't brothers? Or did I admit?
No, you heard me say that exactly right. Now, this is a bit of a debate in the commentaries. And I think I'm right, you know? I think my side is right on this one. So I did say what I believe the text says. Here's what it says in James. James 1:9. Let the poor brother. The brother is the prominent word, and the adjectival expression is poor. Humble poor, anawim, these pious poor people in the Jewish world. Let the poor brother rejoice in his exaltation, because he's now a part of the people of God and he'll inherit the kingdom of God. But then he doesn't say the rich brother. He just says, but the rich. And the language is caustic and sarcasm. It's powerful language. But let the rich rejoice in his humiliation because he's going to be impoverished. Yes, it's coming. You know, payday is coming. And we're going to, it's James 5, 1 to 6, anticipated right there. You know what I mean by
so,
James?
So, yeah, and so did your sense, it seems in James 5 that he's expecting the rich to hear his rebuke and his command to pay the wages. You don't see it that way? Okay.
No, no. He's blasting away at people who have no care for what he's saying. But the word plousios, the word rich in the book of James, is always negative. And this would be the only time it would be a believer. All other references are oppressors. So we learn to read James in light of James. But it's so typical of prophetic literature to act like you're talking to the person when you're not. You know, Isaiah, he's oh, Edom, he's talking about, they're not listening. They could care less what he's saying. So the rich are not listening. Yeah. But this is for the poor. The poor hear that God is going to bring justice against these oppressing, rich, systemic injustice people. And he's gonna rejoice in that day. So that's how I put it. But there are people who think it's a rich brother. And in that case, it's the only time rich is used for a believer in the whole book of James. And it would create tension in the letter, I think. So
if you gave a social profile of the Christian community in the book of James, what would you say?
Oh, that's a nice one. They're Jewish. They are led by males. The males are hotheads who are not afraid of murdering people for the sake of justice. They're poor. They're being oppressed, treated unjustly. And they're workers. They're scattered because of persecution, probably. So it's that kind of profile. Just like anyone who lives in Malibu. So it is, I mean, I think it's responsible exegesis to know that kind of social profile of what he's talking about, to realize this can only be applied to us in a strenuous way. I mean, it stretches it for us to hear it addressed to us. But we need to hear it because we're probably as tone deaf as the rich were in James's day. And we need to hear that. Yes.
Tone deaf and in light of what we can do or should be doing.
You've preached a sermon. I think it's right. I think that we are. I don't want to say that it's intentional ignorance, benign ignorance, that we don't care to look into and open up the window or open the door and see what's behind it. I think we could learn from this.
I would think Timothy is chapter 5 is an example of Paul preaching, helping Timothy construct the sermon about that within that church family setting, a different situation. But
of working, you mean the idea
of dealing with the rich,
yeah,
and what he has to say about that in contrast.
But now look, Paul goes around raising money from rich people. And he'll take it from anyone, but it's also ordinary Christians who are being very generous with their income. And Paul chooses to work rather than, at Corinth, he chooses to work rather than to be dependent upon them because they've got the wherewithal to support him as a traveling philosopher, and he says no, and this really ticks them off. He's offended them. He's hurt their national pride. So all these tensions about money in the Bible, but they play out. They are symptoms of things going on under the surface about obedience, discipleship, how we are generous, how we love our neighbor, how we respond to what the gifts that we have, what kind of work ethic we have. So
maybe have time for one more.
How much do you think paternal ethics is still playing a role later in the first century, as far as the quid pro quo, you know, when you have a dinner, it'd be only with one that could repay you in return, and
What'd you call it at the beginning?
Paternal ethics is a term I've studied on it.
Yeah.
And I kind of tied it into what you said in the prior session on, and it really struck me heavy, was that Jesus is bigger than the benefits he brings. I thought that was really hit home. And I think when you're attached to that socioeconomic culture that is based on this quid pro quo, then you still look at your relationship with Jesus as what, kind of going back to the Old Testament, the wisdom side, this is what I get out of this relationship.
Yeah. Well, clearly the paternalism of the first century of patrons is that, you know, you strike up a relationship with someone to get something from them and they get labor out of you. And Paul refused that. He refused that sort of relationship. I think at times that's the one you have to be in. The slaves had no option. You know, they had to get money, and they could only do it by being enslaved to someone. So it's so different than our socioeconomic system. So I would like to say that the Bible has no capitalism. I think some people think it does. There's no capitalism in it. And it's not that it's against capitalism. It's that it hadn't arisen yet. So we learned some principles about how to manage with justice what we have.
That's true.